another is supporting the Sudanese themselves. Like, there's no safety, security, and all of this. And we are all here calling, like, there's no one here to, like, we are here not, like, to leave anyone behind, but unfortunately, Sudanese people are behind the table, and we are depending, and no one literally talking about us.
Lena, I want to thank you so much for standing here and speaking up for your country, for your people. Lena Issa is a climate justice advocate from Sudan. And I want to thank Lydia Nakpil, longtime climate activist and co-chair of the People's Plenary that just take place. She is a Filipina climate activist. And I want to thank Jana Rashid, a climate advocate, Palestinian based in Lebanon. We thank you all for being with us as we wrap up our show today. We only have a few seconds. We want to also thank Harjeet Singh, who came to this summit from New Delhi, India. Thousands of people have gathered. I think it's something like 77,000 people are registered for this UN Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan. Next year, it will take place in Brazil, in the rainforest right on the edge. Well, we want to thank the amazing team of people who helped us today. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warren, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio.
You're listening to Community Radio,
KBOO, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Dr. Zom's Stereo Obscura. Offbeat sounds for talented listeners. Broadcasts every other Wednesday at 10 p.m.
De nuevo, esta música de Bali.
There was heaven and there was earth.
Después de esta pieza, vamos a escuchar una comunicación.
That's Dr. Zom's Stereo Obscura, every other Wednesday from 10 to midnight, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, with the Republicans about to take power, Oregon could take a second look at banning book bans. A large payout from Portland to a protester from an incident with a police officer in 2020. And new research shows Trump's proposals will hike taxes for middle-class families. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, November 21st, 2024. I'm Minette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Oregon Senate Bill 1583, which would ban book bans in the state, may resurface this spring. Isabel Charlet explains that book bans are intensifying in the current political climate since the election.
In the wake of Trump's re-election, teachers nationwide are bracing for more censorship battles. Currently, more than 40 laws in 22 states restrict teaching about race, gender, history, and queer identities. Oregon is not immune to this trend, with 93 book removal attempts last year, a 30-year record. Educators recently shared their experiences with censorship at the Teaching Truth Forum. Seattle-based Jesse Hagopian is the author of Teach Truth, The Struggle for Anti-Racist Education.
You're hearing from a lot of teachers already about what the repression looks like, but it's severe right now. You're dealing with almost half of all kids going to a school where it's illegal for kids to learn the truth about U.S. history.
Lisa Stiller is a retired teacher who worked in rural and urban Oregon school districts. She says it's important to give students space to ask questions about uncomfortable topics in school.
If you think that a book with racial content has some deep issues, I want to hear why. I don't want the discussion to be thrown out because it's controversial.
Most attempts at banning books have been unsuccessful so far in Oregon, meeting legal challenges by the ACLU and other civil rights groups. In September, a new rule banning Portland public school teachers from posting anything personal or political in their classrooms was met with an official grievance from the teachers' union. Hagopian says it's not enough to try to reverse laws that restrict teaching around racism and LGBTQ plus issues.
We're fighting to expand Black studies, ethnic studies, queer studies, gender studies in our schools so every kid can understand themselves, see themselves, and be empowered with the history of social movements they need to change this system.
I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Oregon U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley joined an effort led by Vermont's Bernie Sanders to protest the U.S. contribution to the deaths of innocent civilians in Gaza. Merkley, Sanders, and a small group of other senators tried to win support for joint resolutions of disapproval, a test of frustration about the war that would stop about $20 billion worth of bombs, tanks, and mortar rounds going to Israel.
The U.S. government wants a ceasefire for hostage deal. Netanyahu has prevented a deal.
I think that true partners do not stand idly by when their partners go way off track in destructive ways. We should not continue to provide the munitions that we are voting on.
A 30-day deadline came and went for Israel to meet new specific targets to improve its treatment of Palestinian civilians in Gaza. Merkley argued,
we must not continue to provide offensive weapons that make the United States complicit in the deaths of tens of thousands of Palestinians, the injury of 100,000 more innocent.
But Oregon's other senator, Ron Wyden, voted against it, and so did Washington Senators Maria Cantwell and Patty Murray. Nevada Senator Jackie Rosen spoke out for the other side.
This week, Israelis were wounded and killed after Hezbollah launched more rockets at northern Israel. The resolutions we are debating not only hurt Israel's ability to defend itself against these attacks, they would embolden Iran.
Three votes on the issue went down to defeat Idaho Senator James Risch.
For 76 years, the United States has stood with the State of Israel, our strongest ally in the Middle East. But today, members of this body are sending a message that United States support for Israel is in question. It is not.
Multnomah County Elections has now counted roughly 8,000 more ballots since its last update on November 13th. None of the preliminary results have changed in light of this recent update. Keith Wilson's confirmed as Portland's new mayor in District 1, which includes Portland's Outer East Side neighborhoods. Candace Avalos, Loretta Smith, and Jamie Dunphy continue to lead. In District 2, which covers most of North and Northeast Portland, Elena Pertle-Guinney, Dan Ryan, and Samir Kanal are leading. District 3, which spans a large part of Southeast Portland, Steve Novick, Angelita Murillo, and Tiffany Coya-Mullane lead the race. And in District 4, which encompasses all of Portland west of the Willamette River, Olivia Clark, Mitch Green, and Eric Zimmerman are in the lead. One additional update scheduled for November 27th, the final count before official results are certified and shared on December 2nd. At this point, results are preliminary and subject to change as more ballots are counted. The remaining ballots include overseas and military voters whose ballots will have to be duplicated onto machine-readable ballots for processing. Other remaining ballots include cases with challenged signatures, for example, when a voter didn't sign the return ballot or when it has a non-matching signature. Those voters have been informed that they have until November 26th to address the challenges. And as most of the votes are now counted, setting up the 12 new members, a new mayor, and a new auditor for Portland's new form of city council, what comes next? The person in charge of that says this marks a revolutionary change for Portland, Current Mayor Ted Wheeler appointed Michael Jordan the interim city administrator.
Portland, for a lot of its history, had been Stumptown, the wide spot in the road between Seattle and San Francisco. And we're not that anymore. But we're a big city. We have big city challenges. My job is really to be the ramrod, if you will, to get the city organization ready for this transition. And we started even before the election in 2022 to get ready for this and be prepared, because there were just a huge number of things that had to be done. Many of them had to be done, absolutely must be done on time. So we had to form districts. We needed to change our election code. Most people think, gee, you had 2 years to do this. It can't be that tough. We had to actually change our election code by the spring of 2020 so that we could get that to Multnomah County, so that they could do all of the work to change their software and prepare for ranked choice voting. And so the lead time was long on many of the aspects, and we absolutely had to get them done on time to make sure we were ready to run a successful election. I think most everybody has probably heard by now, we've moved from five elected officials that acted both as the legislative branch, if you will, of our city government, but also in the commission form, acted as the executive and the administrative components of our city government. And we're transitioning to a very different form, one that has 12 elected legislators, 3 from each of 4 districts. Now, where we'll have this division of labor, if you will, in city government that is a much more a full division than it has ever been before. And that is 12 representatives from 4 districts that will be the legislative branch. Their job will be to make laws, adopt policy. They have the power of the purse strings. They will ultimately adopt the city's budget each year. And the mayor will act as the elected executive to be accountable for the day-to-day operations.
He points out a lot of new faces are coming on board, 14 newly elected.
We've been doing a lot of things to get ready to onboard we're calling them the freshman class of legislators and a new mayor. And we're going to be doing probably the most intense onboarding that's ever been done at the city in December. That, of course, will go on for months. The one thing that wasn't in the charter language that we have been spending a lot of time working on is reorganizing city government. However, the new mayor, in their role as executive, is required by charter to appoint a professional city administrator. That person will actually have the day-to-day operating authority and responsibility, being responsible both to the mayor directly and also to the city council, both of which can remove the administrator unilaterally. The mayor has hire and fire authority over the administrator. The council also can remove the administrator with a 9-vote supermajority. So that person will be accountable both to the mayor directly every day, but also accountable to the legislative branch to be able to make sure they can do their job and pass laws and policies, deliberate on budgets and all of the issues that go on in the city. It presents a cultural shift in city government that, quite frankly, will take years to fully realize. It's one thing to draw new boxes and lines on an org chart. It's quite another thing to change 7,000 people's behavior in a big organization as multifaceted as the city of Portland is. We believed that we needed to reorganize to have a single point of accountability in the city administrator, feel like they can actually manage the 24 offices and bureaus in city government and be comfortable being held accountable for that entire organization by the council and the mayor, and ultimately the residents of Portland. We've never had a single point of accountability before in city government. We had 5 elected officials. The mayor would assign bureaus to those 5 elected officials, but they were not accountable to the mayor, and they were not accountable to each other. They were only accountable to voters once every 4 years. there wasn't that kind of urgency of having accountability in real time every day for the way the organization responds and operates. And I think that's a huge shift. And whoever the person is in this first role as city administrator is going to be charged with infusing that level of urgency and accountability into our city government.
He says he wants to make sure this new class of leaders knows about the very challenging budgets they'll deal with over the next few years.
What we came up with was a fairly standard organizational structure, public works, which includes water and the Bureau of Environmental Services and Transportation, the Bureau of Public Safety, which includes fire and police, emergency communications and emergency management. We've got an economic and community development service area, which has permitting and Prosper Portland, and also the Housing Bureau and the Planning and Sustainability Bureau. We have a City Operations Bureau, which has most of the internal services like HR, IT, fleet and facilities, etc. We developed that to try and give this first city administrator a shot at being able to both manage a big organization with a structure that can do that, and then also a feeling that they can be held accountable. The other thing that we're going through right now is budgeting in a very different way. These service areas that report to deputy city administrators that then report directly to the city administrator. That structure we took to the current city council back in November of 23, about a year ago, and we asked them to consider it and ultimately approve it, which they did. They added one more service area called Vibrant Communities, and it holds parks and the Parks Bureau, the Children's Levy, and the art function. So that's a sixth service area. We asked them to do that last November because we had to budget into that new structure for the fiscal year we're currently in, starting July 1 of 24 and ending June 30 of 25. We have to hand this budget to the brand new mayor and new city council right in the middle of the budget year on January 1st of 2025. The final big thing we're doing to prepare for January of 2025 is that Mayor Wheeler, with his current authority under the current charter to assign bureaus, assigned all the bureaus to himself back on July 1st of this year, and then delegated his commissioner in charge authority over all the bureaus to me to do what I like to say is begin to practice how this thing will run on January 1st of next year. We all, I think, believed, including the current commissioners, that it would be impractical for us to run the city the old way to December 31st, flip a switch and hand the keys to the new mayor and expect it to run the way it's expected to run in the future. And so it was really important that we had a six-month shakedown cruise to be able to work out the kinks, get an understanding of what it meant to have a single point of authority. The other thing that we're trying to do in this new process that we, quite frankly, have done a abysmal, not a very good job of in the past, and that is engage the public in the challenging questions that each budget faces. And we are going to face some very challenging budgets for the next few years. And a new freshman class of legislators, a new mayor, and we will begin to work with them on some really challenging trade-offs, whether it's the homeless crisis in our city or it's a public safety structure that is currently burning overtime like crazy because we're understaffed. We've got a problem with our utilities because they are having capital budgets like a new filtration plant for the Water Bureau that's eating up their operational budgets, and a Transportation Bureau that, quite frankly, is being funded with an antiquated funding system. And they are simply, and this is not an overstatement, slowly going out of business unless we change the fundamentals of their revenue structure. This new council will face some really big budget challenges going forward.
Current Mayor Ted Wheeler appointed Michael Jordan the interim city administrator. Portland City Council has voted to pay a protester $400,000 in settlement for a case involving police excessive force. It's the largest settlement stemming from the protest in 2020 to date. Portland has paid out $3 million in settlements to victims of police violence during that time. Dustin Ferreira is the most recent recipient. He was born with osteogenesis imperfecta, a disease that causes brittle bones. He uses a wheelchair. At a protest September 28th of that year, Police Sergeant Justin Damerville spoke to him outside a 7-Eleven before suddenly yanking him by the arm with enough force to lift his wheelchair off the ground. Video footage from the encounter shows Damerville pulling him away several feet and handcuffing him as the crowd started shouting in protest. Damerville said the protesters were told to leave several times or be arrested. Ferreira was not prosecuted for his charge, interfering with an officer. Damerville resigned from the force in 2022 and now works as a police officer in Tennessee. The decision to pay the $400,000 settlement was recommended by the City Attorney's Office and Risk Management Services. Many cases of Portland police using excessive force on protesters in the 2020 racial justice protests have already been settled, but there are dozens more still pending. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, rain likely down to 47, higher wind gusts possible. Tomorrow's weather, rain in the morning becomes more intermittent by the afternoon, a high of 54. Today in history, on this date in 1931, the horror film Frankenstein was released, starring Boris Karloff as the monster. Our quote of the day is from Karloff, who said, "Success is not final. Failure is not fatal. It is the courage to continue that counts." A coalition has defeated a repeal of the Washington Climate Act. Mark Richardson reports this will keep the state on track to reach its pollution reduction goal by 2050 and preserve jobs.
On Election Day, a broad coalition of conservationists, labor, and others helped defeat a ballot initiative to repeal Washington State's Climate Commitment Act. The act, passed in 2021, is the state's primary vehicle for reducing emissions and pollution and a major source of funding for clean energy infrastructure and climate initiatives. Billy Wallace with the Washington and Northern Idaho District Council of Laborers says passage would have meant the loss of as many as 45,000 clean energy jobs.
We started building a coalition and it ended up being a little over 600 groups from labor, from environmental. The Catholic Church was on it. We had 21 of the 29 tribes sign on. So it was a very diversified coalition that came together to save this funding.
Initiative 2117 was one of four ballot measures backed by the Let's Go Washington PAC, funded primarily by conservative hedge fund manager Brian Haywood. Wallace says that over the next 8 years, the Climate Commitment Act investments would create 45,000 jobs in Washington state. Wallace says the coalition faced an uphill battle to help the public understand that jobs and the environment were both on the line.
These are the investments, even in schools, clean air, clean water. And once we figured out we got to educate the people on what's going on, it was complicated, it was confusing for the general public. So we raised $18.4 million for this campaign from that big coalition.
Climate Jobs Washington and its member unions formed the coalition to protect the act. Wallace says labor organizations were instrumental in passing the original measure 3 years ago.
It was crucial for our members. Our members work in the building trades. About 75-80% of the work we do is on prevailing wage work in transpo. So it was a no-brainer for us to jump in.
For Washington News Service, I'm Mark Richardson.
The middle 20% of American families will face a tax hike of more than $1,500 a year under President-elect Trump's proposals. As Eric Galatis reports, that's what the Nonpartisan Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy predicts.
President-elect Donald Trump and Republicans in Congress have promised to pass a new tax bill, and a new report breaks down the expected winners and losers. Joe Hughes with the Nonpartisan Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy says based on Trump's campaign proposals, the top 1%, those making more than $900,000 a year, will see their tax bill go down by more than $36,000 on average.
The top 5% of households make more than $360,000 a year. They will likely see their taxes go down. For the other 95% of Americans, they will likely see their taxes go up.
Hughes says Americans earning between $55,000 and $94,000 a year would have to pay out over $1,500 more in income taxes. The combined increases would further shift the tax burden to pay for bridges, schools, health care, and highways from corporations and higher-income individuals to low- and middle-income families. Trump has claimed, without evidence, that increasing tariffs on foreign goods would cover revenues lost due to tax cuts. Hughes says because companies pass the costs of tariffs along to consumers, Americans will also be hit with what is essentially a national sales tax. He adds the incoming administration's proposals, if enacted, could increase the national debt by as much as $15 trillion over the next decade.
The proposals to increase tariffs are not going to raise enough revenue to offset the tax cuts that he's proposed to give to high-income individuals and to corporations.
Trump has called the election results a mandate for his policies, but Hughes notes a strong majority of Americans support a tax code that's fair, one that asks those who can afford it to contribute more. They don't think billionaires such as Elon Musk should pay less than working families.
There is some disconnect here between the candidate that they voted for and the policies that actually poll well with voters.
This is Eric Galatis.
I'm a survivor of rape, sexual violence, and abuse. The idea of a man walking into a locker room where I'm changing feels like assault. And I'm going to stand in the way of any guy that wants to come into our spaces.
The issue of transgender rights is now front and center in Congress. There's been an historic win for Utah's youngest elected official. And now comes scrutiny of Democratic leadership. With more on the stories affecting our democracy, here is today's edition of 2024 Talks.
South Carolina Republican Nancy Mace is sponsoring a House bill to bar transgender people from restrooms outside of their birth sex in federal buildings, including the Capitol. Mace says it's aimed specifically at Delaware Democrat Sarah McBride, the first openly transgender member of Congress. McBride calls the bill an extremist distraction. She says Congress should focus on real issues like reducing the cost of housing, healthcare, and childcare. The House Ethics Committee split in a party-line deadlock on whether to release the results of its drugs and sex trafficking investigation into former Congressman Matt Gaetz. Joe Leppard is the attorney for a woman who testified that she saw the attorney general pick have sex with a 17-year-old.
Whether or not a federal prosecutor takes a case and decides to move forward on a trial or move forward on an allegation is that particular prosecutor's decision. It doesn't mean they didn't do it.
ABC News just released receipts for $10,000 of payments the Florida Republican reportedly made to two women who testified about his role in drug-fueled parties. Gaetz has repeatedly denied the allegation. Progressives are criticizing the Democratic Party for forgetting the needs of working families. Usama Andrabi with Justice Democrats says the party's reliance on corporate backing has disillusioned its base voters and cost it the election.
Any other sector of the economy, a failure this large would demand the firing of those in charge. Clean up shop and purge the party of these donors, pundits, and politicians that brought us another Trump presidency.
In Utah, 19-year-old Jackson Lewis will join his local school board, becoming the state's youngest elected official. Lewis, who is openly gay, says his victory represents progress for young and marginalized people.
As a gay man, it means a lot to me and the queer students in the district, even members of the football team, of the debate team. They are all excited that someone this young is representing student interests on this board.
Utah recently enacted a law allowing parents to challenge books they consider to have sensitive materials. Lewis says he plans to oppose book bans. I'm Farah Siddiqui.
Tribes are celebrating California's removal of a derogatory word from sites. The new Trump term could impact tribal climate restoration and protection. And wildlife migration patterns in the West are likely to shift due to climate change. Here's today's edition of National Native News.
Tribes in California are celebrating after state officials approved the renaming of more than 30 place names containing the derogatory SQ word across 15 counties. Jacob Resnick reports.
Most of the place names are county roads, but also at least one cemetery and a building containing the SQ word that only in recent years has universally been recognized for what it is, a racial slur against Native American women.
It is undoing the derogatory language that is not only defamatory, but erases our history and hence us as a people.
That's Greg Saris, chairman of the Federated Indians of the Great Rancheria, north of San Francisco Bay.
There's a lot in that sentence, but it's so true. I don't think people understood that the SQ word is comparable to, for us, to the N-word.
The renaming initiative is the fruit of California Assembly Bill 2022. Under the legislation passed 2 years ago, the geographic places will be renamed in consultation with California tribes, with priority given to honoring tribal cultures and indigenous languages. For National Native News, I'm Jacob Resnick in Sonoma County, California.
With a second Trump term near, tribes in Oregon and elsewhere are concerned for their environmental restoration efforts. KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
In his first presidential term, Trump opened up lands considered sacred to Native people for development, as well as rolling back dozens of environmental protections. In a call of tribal officials, Oregon Governor Tina Kotek said she'll stand with Oregon values as the White House changes hands again.
My hope is we will see respect and cooperation from the federal administration to work with our tribes.
Kotek says she's focused on the Columbia Basin Initiative, which worked with President Biden to restore fish runs. William Ray Jr., chair of the Klamath Tribes, then spoke about protecting salmon and two species of suckerfish.
Our biggest concerns about the incoming administration is the water delivery systems and how it's going to affect our endangered species of Tuam and Coptu mullet species. If all the water delivery agreements are going to be fulfilled at 100%, extinction becomes real viable.
Trump has discussed diverting water from the Columbia River to California and also questioned the need for protecting the endangered Delta smelt there. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
A new study shows that wildlife migration patterns in the West will likely shift because of climate change. That's why researchers worked with biologists from the Southern Ute tribe to find out how to tackle the problem. The Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Radel has more.
Researchers used GPS data from dozens of elk collared by the Southern Ute tribe in southwestern Colorado. They analyzed their current migration patterns and projected how they will look in 2050 as temperatures rise and precipitation declines. They also considered continued growth and development and the traffic that comes along with it. They found elk could be more spread out in the winters as snowpacks shrink. And in the summers, herds could be more compacted as their range is cut by about half. That means new wildlife crossings, like bridges and tunnels, will be needed, says Caitlin Littlefield. She's with Conservation Science Partners and the study's lead author.
Wildlife crossings can enable